What I thought I'd do is do what everyone loves doing, and that is getting you to ask questions. And the aim is not to... I want to be quite clear from the beginning that one doesn't solve family problems by, in a group like this, talking with theoretical issues. It's often family problems require a long period of time with a lot of effort by people who are committing time to it. What I would like to do is try and bring up issues. And for many of you will be dealing with families. Many of you will be in families yourself, and issues will perplex you. Now, what I propose to say is this. Often what I will be saying will be what is commonly the case. It may not be the case with the person who's asking the question or the case you have in mind. But I want to try to throw open some issues to help you to think out the implications of our faith for practical situations that you may encounter. Because one of the great difficulties is there are those who know the word and know nothing about the sort of problems that we have to grapple with, and there are those who know the problems but don't know the word. Now, I suspect that in both cases I know a little bit of both, and I'm struggling with both to bring them together. And that's what I'd like to try and share today. So I wonder if people would like to just ask some questions along some general lines of problem cases that you had to encounter, and I'll begin to discuss the issues that you want to bring up.
A young couple, having been married about 4 years, and we've been happily together, and all of a sudden, the wife goes off with another fellow. Totally unrepentant after, say, a month, 2 months.
Yes.
And what should be the case of the husband at this stage? Should he try and get her back, or what should happen in this case?
Yes, well...
Totally unrepentant.
I think there are several issues here, and... The question is, there's a young couple, been married for 4 years, and seemingly out of the blue. She goes off with... The wife goes off with another man, seems unrepentant for over a period of several months after presumably people have contacted her, and what is to be our ministry, or what's to be our role with regard to the person who is left? Is that right? Right, well, because this is all these issues are very controversial, and so I'll give you what the position I've come to. First of all, I take one step back. The first thing I do with this couple, with the person I have, is to not take the situation at hand, but go into detail as to the history of their relationship. I look back at their relationship, how it developed, and it's rare to find what looks like out of the blue. Is so often the roots of it are back there in the early relationship. Secondly, I always take a history, a family history, of both members' families from which they came. In other words, the family of the husband, the family of the wife, because very often I find a repetitive pattern of relating. The sins of the fathers, the patterns of distorted behaviour carry on to the third and the fourth generations. So if I see any individual, I rarely do it without looking at for instance, if they're an adult, without looking at their family, what's happening in their family, the family they came from, and sometimes it's relevant to go beyond that. If you're going, I believe that's the biblical implication. Looking at people as individuals is a fruitless effort. Now, having done all that, I often get clues, first of all, because people with their family backgrounds are often attracted to people who have the very component in their makeup which will aggravate their problem. Did everyone get that? In other words, the person who resents being dominated but tends to be a little bit of a passive person who wants things done for them marries a domineering person who aggravates the pattern. They aggravate the other person because the other person hates the person who never does anything, never takes responsibility. The two of them come together. If they then try to tackle that and change their behaviour, both of them, then that will help. But what so often happens is one becomes more and more domineering, the other becomes more and more passive, until finally they tear each other apart. Now let's come back to the actual problem. The problem here is, we look, are there any precipitants? Are there any things that have kicked this off? Has there been a death in the family in the last 2 years? If there was, one would look at, to what extent is this rejection a response to a death? That's a very common event. Secondly, to what extent has the person who has been left rejected them prior to them leaving? And that needs to be worked through. Thirdly, if we come to the situation where that person consistently refuses to do anything about their behaviour, I think we have to minister to the needs of the individual. And the first thing I think we have to do is provide them with a sense of support without necessarily colluding with them, without necessarily saying to them, look, we agree with you and that person's the bad one. I think we have to be ready to see their contribution to it. Let me say that the situations that I have had to deal with, I do believe under certain circumstances in divorce. I believe God hates divorce, but I believe that there are certain situations that God hates even more than divorce. Can I give some illustrations? First of all, a young man and woman, pregnant with twins, and this young man beats her up. They've both been through Bible college, they've both made a commitment in the past, the man has had a history over the previous 12 months of hearing voices. When you go into it, in fact, his father had a history of hearing voices and had a personality change, so that he was a very eccentric man, and as he approached his 40s, gradually lost his mind altogether. This young man begins to show the same symptoms in his 20s and begins to become violent with it. He realises as a Christian that his wife is chained to him, if I can put it in that way. He sees it that way, in his own perspective. So he says to his wife, why don't you leave me? His wife says, you know I can't leave you, the scriptures forbid it, except under one situation. The next time he loses contact with reality, this man goes out and says that the only loving thing I can do is have sexual intercourse with a prostitute. And my wife is freed. He does that, but then he comes to me and I treat him for his illness and he improves and gets better. When he got better, he realised that what he had done was wrong. So he asked forgiveness of the Lord. He went back to his wife, who now said, but you see, the exception clause, you fulfilled it. And I find it hard to accept you back because I'm afraid that you'll do it again, and that these two children will be brought up in a home where you're going to become like your father. I spoke to her and said to her of the obligation of her to realise how serious a matter this was and how this could actually make his condition worse. She then accepted and said, right, I realise that though he's been unfaithful, etc., I'll accept him back. His condition became worse, to the extent that he no longer would take his medication because he was so seriously affected, and he then got worse and worse, and now he won't take any medication at all. He's not bad enough to go into a psychiatric hospital, but if he lives with anyone consistently, he ends up hitting them and beating them up, and this girl was beaten up several times during a pregnancy. At this point in time, I have this young woman said to me, look, I've come to the point as a Christian where I believe I've got to divorce him. I have gone along with that. Now, I would see that situation, I would see those sort of circumstances once a week. That sort of person, once a week. Now, admittedly, the vast majority of my patients, I don't have that sort of situation. But once a week is still very common. But I do agree, the scripture is emphatic, as Ian said, that the Lord hates divorce, but the number of alcoholics who are beating their wives, in this situation I think it requires a good period of time, and I would think 12 months is a reasonable period of time, and I think that the reasonable period of time must be a time during which maximum support is given to both parties where possible. Because if the wife, if the husband is left, especially if he's left with the care of the children, and it's a terrible grind, I think we're putting them in a position of insisting, if they don't go into another relationship, of encouraging them to be unfaithful to the Lord, to feel that they're disobeying. The only way we can do it is to bolster them up. Many of the people who are unfaithful or who then go into another relationship de facto are going in because of lack of support. Now, I know they're wrong many times, but are we not more wrong in our lack of support for them? So that's the first one. I've really entered onto a controversial area to start with. Do you have any questions on it?
The fact of the husband, there's no mitigating fact that he's been faithful. He's provided well. There are no children involved.
Yes.
But what sort of counsel should we give him?
Well, I think here, what the first thing I think you should give him a reasonable period of time to look to a reasonable period of time during which he should give her the opportunity of coming back. And during that time to give him maximum support. I think that we should be terribly aware of counselling him of the dangers of a period without a partner. And during that time I would work on his problems. I do not see the key problem in the person who's departed necessarily, and I would work on his problems so that if she comes back, and the likelihood is that she will come back, there's likely to be something there if they've sustained a relationship for 4 years. So I'd work on his problems so there's an attraction to come back. And particularly refusing to buy into his desire to continually dwell on her problem. But working, say, look, we've agreed that she's got a problem, now let's work on your problem and continue to persist with it. And in doing that, I think you will often get him to the situation where he'll be able to come back. Yes.
On a similar situation, how do you, like Ian McDowell has said, enclose the person who has gone wrong in love? Full acceptance, how does it square up with Paul's admonition to isolate a believer who has gone astray, so that the very isolation may bring him back to repentance?
Yes.
That also works in this kind of relationship, that suppose this particular case, that the girl has gone off, if she is isolated from her family and everything, could that, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Should we surround her in love, or should she be feel rejected by the family?
Yeah. Yes, I think there are several issues here. There's the issue of to say to the person, look, I'm sorry, we really care for you, but our care, we want to give you our care when you come back into this situation. Now, if the person has gone away and there were obviously a whole lot of circumstances, which is often the case, and this person is not unrepentant, but just feels that they can't go back. And I think that's the most common situation. They just say, look, I'm sorry, I just can't go back at the moment. I realise I'm doing the wrong thing, but I just can't face it. Now, that person I would get in and give maximum support to. But if a person says, look, I've done nothing wrong, there's just no point in you talking to me about it, and they just don't respond. Is that the sort of person you meant? Yeah. Then if they're doing that, I think you have to back. I think you have to respect what they're saying, and in that sense I don't think you embrace them with love. I think you leave them with a message of concern, but you withdraw. And that withdrawal is a very powerful message for them to come back, because lack of support is one of the most... They will seek support, and they will seek the support of that the local church is offering. Whereas the person who's left, they will seek support. If the local church doesn't give it, they will seek support from another partner. So the issue is, if you withdraw support from the person who is unrepentant, they will long for support and it may lead them back to repentance. if you give support to the person who realises their need and is asking for help, that will prevent them, insofar as possible, from entering into temptation. Does that answer your question? Yes. Well, yes. The question is the issue of the maltreatment of children, which of course follows on. The issue of maltreatment of children, what are the danger signals in a family? Is that what you're asking? The danger signals in a family that might lead us to suspect this. As you know, the incidence of battered children is very high. And this is one of the other situations where I encourage the partners to separate, where mum is staying with a man who is violent, and particularly towards the children. I've had a case recently of this, two cases, one where mum refused to leave because she felt desperately dependent on this man, and the child came in with a fractured femur, the major bone in the leg, and another case where the child was ended up being thrown from the first floor of a set of units, another one with full thickness burns on the hands. In this situation, I do recommend divorce. In that situation, although not always, but almost, I think this is one of the very powerful arguments. Let me give you again, I'm dealing with the pathological. I think when Ian was talking, he was mainly dealing with the normal situation. So I'm seeing perhaps a different group. So don't think that I'm sort of just criticising everything. That I agree with Ian's point that God hates divorce, but let me say God hates some other things worse than divorce. The danger signals are the unsupported parents. That is, those parents where they've got no structure around them, no extended family, no grandparents, where they themselves were battered children. Battered children often grow up to batter. And the story is just so repetitive. It was good enough for Dad to hit me, and look, I'm all right, aren't I? And that's the whole problem. And then that's the other sign. The other sign is when the children, you see the children, and the children, when they relate to mum or dad, are absolutely docile. Now, you know, healthy children are not absolutely docile. And these children, when we see them in casualty, for instance, a child comes in and they've got a broken bone, and you see them relate, and they are good children, if I can put it that way. They do everything their parents say. In fact, their parents only have to look at them and they cringe. Now, that's not a normal response. These parents are always great disciplinarians. Now, you've heard all the good sides of punishment this morning, and of course they have to be emphasised in an era which, in some cases, underemphasises that. But these people always say, my kids won't step out of line, and they lay it on them very hard. And of course these kids grow up to be very, if they survive, they grow up to be very depressed kids, very depressed adults, and often violent. And if you look in your jails, most of your jails are full of these people. The one of the cardinal features that distinguishes the parents are parents who cannot accept responsibility that they are doing something wrong. Whenever you say to them, look, haven't you noticed that you've got a problem in this way and this way and this way? It's like you're talking to a blank screen and it bounces off them. And they deny having any... And as you talk with them, you come to realise they actually believe it. And secondly, they put onto others the feelings they have themselves. So often this person will tell you about all the horrific things that other parents do to their children. And in fact, what they're telling you are the things that they are afraid of doing themselves. And those are clues when you're working with people. You'll get to know them because they're people that give you this feeling. You get the feeling, can't they see what they're doing? and they often are very legalistic. This is even in the non-Christian group. Everything is absolutely black and white. If that child steps over the line, you know, as one lady said, if my child crawls out on the road, it should know better. It happened to be that this child was a retarded child and she didn't want this child now. And the child would be killed. And in fact, the worrying thing in this lady's case was that she drew out an insurance policy on the child's life at 5 years of age. And in that case, I took a very strong stand. So there's some of the unusual situations. Does that give you some clues anyway?
Can you identify some early indications of severe difficulties that are going to arise within a marriage?
Yes. I think that... the question is, can we give some early indicators of the marriages that are likely to have severe problems? Is that correct? Right. Well, I think one of the first indicators is where the couples involved have entered upon marriage with virtually little consideration and a feeling of drivenness. Now what I mean, or a compulsion to get together. Now what I mean by that is the sort of passionately in love idea. The Hollywood idea of getting together and, almost invariably, that getting together quickly like that and just feeling that they've got to be with one another is can be a sign of really serious problems later on. Why I say that? Now, to an extent, all of us choose our partners for reasons we know not what. We like to think that we consider it rationally. We like to think that we weigh it out before the Lord, but I suspect that the Lord guides us much over and above anything we might think about it. That's right. They're one of the mysteries of life, definitely. So that's the first thing, because that is just the situation where a person will tend to choose someone that will highlight their own problems. The second situation is where you can see very clearly in the beginning that one person is the mainstay and the other person is hanging on. That is, there is a clear, one person is very strong and one person is very weak. Now, I think that's in just normal lay terms, strong and weak as seen from the outside. Now, in fact, the strong person is often inwardly very weak, and their attraction to another person who has the same sort of weakness on the inside is often the case. But so that's a situation where those couples need to be pulled together and said, look, have you noticed this? Because there are some people who desperately need to be needed. So they marry someone who's very dependent upon them. And the classic example is of the daughter of the alcoholic who has become a very caring, loving person, often may end up going into a caring profession like nursing, and then goes and marries someone who is really reliant upon them. Here you've got the good, caring person, daughter of the alcoholic, who then marries someone who is just like that. Or you've got the son of the alcoholic, and if you don't think that this is common, 1 in 5 of the population have an alcoholic in their family. That's a lot. Or in Australia, for instance, there's 400,000 alcoholics on a conservative estimate. That's a lot of people. So that where you get a dependent person on a person who is seemingly very strong, that's an indicator of problems. One of the indicators of problems is the couple that cannot fight. The couple that are unable to sit down and have a good argument with one another. They sit there and agree with one another all the time. This couple is in real strife. One of the problems is in the Christian community, I'll bring this up later, but one of the problems in the Christian community is the inability to sit down and wrangle things out in a constructive way and for reasonable compromises to be reached. It happens in marriage and in the elders' meetings and all those places. I won't buy into that. But the ability to be angry but to sin not has been lost in the Christian community. And so what we need to do is to teach our people who are getting married how to fight. Now, if they're fighting 24 hours a day, that is a problem. But to be able to have a fight and feel that your marriage hasn't fallen apart is definitely a very healthy sign. One of the most severe cases of a childhood depression that I have seen this year, a 16-year-old girl, was in a family where the Christian parents and the doctor had seen them. I get people referred to me just by doctors within the hospital. It's not on the basis of being a Christian or otherwise. And they referred this family to me because they had never seen such a severely depressed young girl, and she presented with abdominal pain. They couldn't find any cause for the abdominal pain, and subsequently it was found to be this tremendous depression. And when we saw the family, the parents said, "You know, we're just such a close family, doctor. It's nice of you to see us, and we're very happy that you've seen us. We're really just such a close family. We never argue." I said, "Really?" And she said, "No." She said, "Do you remember the last time we argued?" And the husband looked rather threatened and said, "No, dear." And then he said, "I think we've argued 5 times. No, it was 4 in the last 25 years. And in this family, this man was so unable to express his anger, and yet he just was full of anger brimming inside him. And as he began to express it, it was absolutely terrifying, you know, just the amount of anger that was bottled up inside him. And this girl, who was terribly angry at her family, could not be angry, could not get angry in any way, and as a result was pushing all the anger inside her. A normal child will get angry sometimes with their parents, and the parents will tassel it out with them and go crook on them, and they'll have a minor rebellion on hand, and then they'll settle down. That's normal. But this girl wasn't able to do that. And when the time came for her to leave home, when she was even beginning to look like leaving home, it was a major crisis, because she had been so conformed to doing exactly what Mum and Dad said. They had never let her develop as an individual. She was never allowed to disagree. And no one in their family disagreed. And the only way out was to get sick. The only way out of this terrible situation in the family. I saw a similar case in a family in which the boy was paraplegic. Not due to physical causes. And these are very difficult cases to treat. But they do respond, and it's quite tremendous when you see them responding. But the parents invariably say, "But doctor, we're a close family," and they are. They're suffocatingly close. Like they're so close that they can't let out any anger at all. They cannot be angry but sin not.
What did you do with that family?
Well, I saw them for a period of time. And eventually what this family do is they have a very unique ability. They have the unique ability of anyone in their environment being able to gradually get everyone around them angry, and them being able to sit still. So, you know, just quiet. This is the sort of person who has tremendous rage inside them and comes in and says, "How are you going? Believe you're all fighting with one another here." Gets the whole place absolutely raging, and then just quietly walks out. You know, everyone else gets angry for them. And this family, one of the things they did was gradually try to get me to be extremely angry with them. I said to them, "You know, you really want to get me angry, don't you?" They said, "Are you?" Almost excited. And as we worked through it and pointed out what was happening. And the other thing that is interesting with these families that cannot express anger, they can't express really close affection. They can talk about love and affection, but if you hold in anger hard enough, you also hold in affection. And there are some people who are very controlled people. They're holding in all their anger, being very controlled, but they also find it terribly difficult. I have great sympathy with these people. Find it very difficult to be close and to express affection, because their doors have, so to speak, been locked to the outside world, and to let out what they're really feeling inside is really very terrifying for them. How did I get to that point? I think it was, what was it? Oh, yes, how you treat them. Well, you follow them through, and these people, they take up to 10, 15 hours of treatment. But when you think of how many years they've been like it, you can understand that that's a reasonable thing.
To release their anger.
Well, what happens is that as... I'm just trying to think who said... I think it was Arthur said, sin is repetitive, and these repetitive things come out. When they relate to me, they bring it out. It gradually comes out. And I'm gradually... They try and bring me into the family system and try and make me conform to do exactly what the family does. And I point out what they're doing to me. For instance, in the individual situation, it's much easier to illustrate with an individual. The individual who always feels rejected. When you deal with them in therapy, what you do is, bit by bit, they come to put themselves in a position of wanting you almost to reject them. And what you do is you say to them something like this. You know, they come in and they say, they don't talk, very quiet, and you say, you're very quiet today. And they say, yes, I just wonder whether it's all worthwhile. Say, you don't think there's much point in coming. Oh, no, I suppose it helps some people. And you say, you give me the feeling that things are getting pretty, you don't have much hope about what's going to happen. Oh, no, you try hard, doctor. And smile. You say, it sounds like you feel at the moment that I'm fairly helpless as far as helping you. Oh, well, yes, doctor, I have been thinking that. And you say, well, you know, do you really want me to be helpless? Do you really want me to be in the position of being helpless and that you're beyond my help? Oh, no, I wouldn't think that. And then I point out, because often what's happened during that week, I use illustrations to point out how that's happened. Or do you really want me to reject you? One girl always used to come in and she'd say, oh, look, I can't think today. I just can't think. It's just gone from me. And, of course, it's very irritating to have someone doing that. And, you know, and she'd say, you must be getting angry with me. And she'd say, look, I'll tell you what about we call it quits for today? This is after 10 minutes in a 45-minute interview. And I say, you really want to run away from it? You really want me to push you out the door, don't you? And say, well, look, it's a bit of a waste of time. And when you point that out, these people are always surprised that they are setting you up for rejection. They're setting you up to reject them, to prove that you really don't care, just like Dad didn't care and Mum didn't care and so-and-so didn't care. And it's a repetitive pattern. And that's the characteristic. And when people begin to see that pattern and that you are not conforming to the pattern, you refuse to be drawn into rejecting them. That you will accept them no matter what. In that brief period of time, this is a corrective experience for them. And I call it the healing that occurs in relationships. I believe that factual content rarely heals people. But it's in the context of a relationship in which the pattern of wrong relationships that occurred in their previous life is corrected. And the person comes to believe that someone can be trusted. I was interested to see that Arthur put in popular psychology in his thing. I was very interested because I was glad that he made that distinction. It's very interesting that some of the leading fields in psychotherapy today are talking about the fundamental characteristic of healing is the beginning of basic trust. That trust is the most fundamental thing that a person can learn. And you might be surprised to hear non-Christians talking about that. But some of them have sort of come to see that that's the case. And for me, that's got a vertical and a horizontal dimension. Anyway, I'll leave it there.
You say, in this relationship, establishing the situation, is it not not then the point to draw out the fact that God will accept them, and that the relationship that now can be restored is the greatest thing that can ever happen to them? That could be the beginning of a healing mechanism.
Well, what I do, and everyone will have different approaches on this, I'm working in a totally secular, not totally secular, I'm in a Catholic hospital, but I'm working in one sense in a secular framework. What I do is I work through them coming to have some sort of trust in me and yet realising my inadequacies. The just total unqualified trust in me is not a cure as far as I'm concerned. They've got to work through that trust and get to the point where they can trust one human being. Now, having done that and established that, I'm continually delighted to see people say, you know, we haven't talked much about Christian things. This is in the last two sessions, the one person I saw for 20 hours. And in the last two sessions she said, you know, I know you're a Christian and I'm a Christian. She said, and we haven't talked much about Christian things, but she said, you know, over the last month, she said, I've had a real reawakening of my spiritual experience because I feel like I can trust God again. And that is so often, I've had that happen again and again, that people, that so often there are emotional barriers that are stopping them from, they are throwing upon God all the dissatisfaction that they have with their relationships around them. God really cops a lot, you know. If you tell someone, you know, God is just like your father, just to ask them first what their father was like, please. Because he's a loving father, may conjure up completely different expectations. So I do bring them to that point, Graham, but some people would say that some people would be quicker than me. Now, I might spend, in the case of one patient I spent 40 hours with them prior to talking about those things. But then when I do, one has a credibility with them that, and there are other people who I meet for the first time and they get it straight between the eyes. It's just I have to assess their receptiveness to it.
Just going back a little bit, there are a relationship between reality and there's another aspect of spirituality, and sometimes you've got to deal with one exclusively to the other at times. Would that be true or false?
Can you just explain that?
Well, at your seminar, you spoke of this point of reality,
yes.
Physical reality,
yes.
Of troubles that cause ailments. And then the other, which may not always be related, is spiritual.
Right. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. Yes.
Is it worth mentioning that
yes.
point in relation to Graham's?
Yes.
I'd like to go over this.
Well, if it's the same point, I think one of the difficulties is that the presenting problem is not always the underlying cause. Let me give you some examples, and Tom may have heard some of these examples because they illustrate the points, but the first is a man who presented with lack of assurance of salvation. He had a past history of mental illness and he was on medication. His local pastor in the Reformed Church, as you know, the Reformed Church are very strong on J. Adams, had been preaching to him of his need to give up his sinful patterns of behaviour. And he actually had Adams in his hand as he walked in the door. He said to me, I've tried everything, doctor, and he won't change. This man was absolutely agitated with lack of assurance of salvation. I readjusted his medication and his lack of assurance of salvation rapidly disappeared within the following 24 hours, and he was back to being a good Reformed Calvinist, whatever you like about that. But he was back with his belief, and he said to me, you know, he said, I must have been bad, he said, when you think I'm a Calvinist, and he said, I lost my assurance. So the presenting symptom there was a spiritual one, or another lady I have, who suffers from manic depressive psychosis, where people become extremely elated, extremely depressed. She used to preach on the buses, which is a very good thing, except that she used to preach in motion and not let anyone off the buses. And when she was high, she used to worship with the Pentecostals. When she was normal, she used to worship the Church of Christ. And when she was low, she used to go to the Exclusive Brethren. Now, whatever you might deem her problem, you can see that there's an underlying disease. And the interesting thing that I don't know whether I've done the right thing or not, but on medication, she's stuck in the Church of Christ. Now the thing is, the other thing is that a person with a spiritual problem can present with abdominal pain. They can be in conflict over their acceptance with God and present with abdominal pain or headaches. Or a person with thyroid disease can present with depression, which is an emotional disorder but presents because of a physical problem. Now that means that that so often the spiritual, the physical, the emotional are really interwoven. I was disturbed to hear Dr. Cashel, who made some very good points, say that he felt that schizophrenia was he didn't believe in it as an entity. But the thing that we, in the States, this is a problem. They use schizophrenia to cover, it's like a big umbrella, you cover everything. But here we have very strict criteria, and it's interesting that this particular condition can be the presenting symptom of a brain tumour, thyroid disease, the chronic alcoholic, all these, and so depending on the disorder, you know, you can't challenge a person to a more holy form of life if they've got a brain tumour sitting in their head. That is, for instance, a lady came to me and she said, look, my husband has been extremely, he's making some terrible jokes. They're really distasteful, they're sexual jokes, and the worst thing that happened the other day, I just have come to the end of a tether, he dropped his pants down when some visitors came. He's 40-something, and you know, I really am disturbed. Should I challenge him about it? Well, I said, I think you can challenge him, but it might be, you might get more than you bargained for. It's probably worth looking at why he's doing it. And this man had what we call pre-senile dementia. His brain cells were dying, and we could see that on a special X-ray technique. So can you see that there, what, now that is, it's a sin to run around dropping your pants down if you're completely in touch with things. And normally a person who's had 40 years of not doing that sort of thing, you should wonder why they're doing it now. But can you see how the spiritual, the physical, the emotional have all been affected with the fall? And because they've all been affected with the fall, sometimes you have one symptom showing up with a cause in another area. And so if we divorce spirituality from our physical, emotional reality, then what we're doing is saying our spirituality has no connection. But if we accept that our spirituality is tied up in it, then we accept that there are times when people who seem to have spiritual problems are in fact suffering from very real emotional or physical problems. Is that the point you wanted me to... Yes.
You might put yourself in water, really.
Yes.
You should be treating them for a sickness before you even get...
Yes. Yes, that's right. And, you know, I like to distinguish between the solution and the process to the solution. So often we know that the answer to the world's need is Christ. But if we deliver that undigested, irrelevant, and when people aren't even asking that, we lose the great opportunity to work through with that person the process of how Christ is the answer to them. You see, take another example. The person, a young woman, 32, is married to a man who is in a car accident. And from the time of him being in a car accident, he has severe brain damage, formerly functioning very well. He's a 30-year-old man. He suffers from chronic epilepsy and he has fits all the time. He is depressed because the areas of his brain that have been affected are involved with mood.
this man is so severe that he is constantly suicidal. Now, he came into the hospital, and in fact there is no medication to help this man. We can help his fits, we can help him a little bit with his depression, but it is unresponsive to any medication. And this man and he has the prospect of living for another 20 years. To this man, I said to him, look, I don't have a solution to your immediate problem. But as a Christian, I can say to you, while there is no hope for you, and he frankly faced his hopelessness, while there is no hope for you in this world of gaining your intelligence back or whatever, I will attempt to show you the love of the person who in a coming day offers you hope. Now, I could only say that after spending quite a bit of time with him and really trying to do something about his problem, spending time with his wife and his children, who had tried to live with this man who was constantly trying to kill himself because of the desperate depression he was in. And believe me, you know, there are very few depressions that aren't treatable. I would say that I have seen just a few that aren't treatable. This man was one, and I had to face that in my own self, the hopelessness. And yet, the belief that by faith there is hope, but it's a hope that's to come.
In that particular instance, how would you tackle that person's problem when they would say, well, if God is so good and loves me so much, why is he in this position?
Yes, well, I deal with most of the bereaved people too in the hospital. So the question is, how do you deal with that person who says, well, if God is good, why does he do this sort of thing? Now, there are two ways of dealing with this. There's the dealing at a logical level, and the logical level is to say, well, look, if you want to solve all problems, you've got to stop all sin. If you want to stop all sin, the judgment's got to come. God in his mercy doesn't want to judge us, so he's holding off. As someone said, don't ask for a cosmic clean-up, you might be some of the trash. Okay? But now, I wouldn't deal with that situation like that. What I do in take the person, that person, or the person who has just lost a child or a loved one, I would approach it like this. The person says, I'd say to them, you know, how do you feel about God? And the person might say to me, I'm just so angry with God. I'm just so angry with God because I cannot understand why he should do this. And I would say to them something like, it is hard to understand, isn't it? That's the first time I heard it. I would say that. Now, the next time I saw them, I might just explore a little bit more. And I would provide the love of God. I would demonstrate the love of God in hearing and listening to that person so that they've got that. And then bit by bit, as the time comes, I have rarely found anyone who, given this approach, will be locked into anger with God. See, most people do not want a logical answer. Most people realise that the world is full of contradictions. A Christian woman who lost her husband recently said this to me. She said, you know, I know there's all a plan. There's a plan in it all. Whenever a person says that to me, it always worries me. I said to her, it's hard to see it sometimes, isn't it? She says, yes, it is. But she says, I know it's all for the best. I said, but it's hard sometimes to see how it's for the best. Yes, she said, it is. And then she said, but still, we press on. I said, I guess sometimes you feel like you don't want to press on. And she burst into tears and she said to me, that's true. She said, I don't want to tell anyone. She said, sometimes I've even felt like just putting an end to my own life. She said to me, you know, somehow I feel less angry with God. Somehow I feel less hopeless just in having shared that. Now, I know that the answer is not always just to listen, just to let people's feelings out. There is a time to be direct. But I suspect that we are, in our society, are too quick. You know, the friends of Job sat with him for all their mistakes. They did sit with him for 7 days before they said anything. They had a validity to speak. They did come from 200 miles away to speak to him. And these friends wept with him. Now, I want to suggest to you that there is a real time for silence. When I've been dealing with the car accidents, the major car accidents, when the people are brought in, and sometimes I just sit with the person, and especially I find it hard when the person who's been killed is the same age as my wife or my child. It's very close to home. And I just sit with them. And sometimes I cry with them too. So, there's a time for silence. There's a time to let the feeling out. And if you read the Psalms, you find that a healthy relationship with God is capable. God is big enough to take our anger. God is big enough to take our accusations. The time will come when he'll just show how big he is to the Job, but he'll let us work it through. And we need to be able to let people work it through. Don't be worried. You don't have to defend God. He really is able to look after himself. And we can come to that position.
Would you, at one point, explain to the person how they will go through this process of denial, anger, depression, shit, back and forth,
I do, but the only thing I don't do is I'm very wary. Particularly, I don't know whether you know Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she talks about that sequence. We got a lot of people coming in, and I actually had a Kubler-Ross counsellor who was killed up there, and her husband was Kubler-Ross, had the sequence of talking about denial, anger, depression and so on, which is true. If you look at it, very often it's true anyway. And he said, I know I'm in the state of denial. And he was intellectualising the whole process. I said to him, it is awful, isn't it, when you want to block things out? And he said, yes, but it won't be long and I'll be all right. I'll go through the stage of anger, etc. And I got angry the other day. And each time I saw him, and one of the things I have found is that people, it's very important not to make people feel that what they are going through is a process that we're just that you've categorised them. That's what I really want to say. It's very important to let them know that what they're going through, that you appreciate, this is a unique experience for them. You know, for instance, if someone says to you, if you say to them, look, you know, I lost my husband the other day, and they say, yes, I lost my husband. I just feel numb. Well, look, it's very easy to understand. You see, there are four stages. And you see, I know that you wouldn't do that, but what I'm suggesting is that, you know how you would feel if someone did that? Well, the person who said to you, you know, my kids did that. And then you say something, well, my kids did that. And you suddenly feel, heavens, you know, no matter what I say, he'll say, my kids did that, and doesn't matter what I say. And that they're not listening to, that they're waiting to identify the process. Now, you do that in your mind. But it's terribly important to relate to the person all the time, letting them know that what they're going through is something unique. See, I see deaths all the time, and people who have lost someone. But if I, for 1 minute, give them the impression, hello dear, you're the 34th bereavement case I've seen this week, that'll just cut them straight away. Do you get what I mean? I think there is a real place, though, for sometimes saying to the person, look, you know, you're getting angry, and that's perfectly understandable. And I do that. And I say to them, you know, I give them some awareness so that they let it, they're not as scared of it. And this is particularly true of the person who stops going to services after they lose a loved one. And I wouldn't pressure them at all. I meet their need, and when you meet their inner need, they'll go back to the services. And the same with the one lady said to me, you know, she said, since my husband died, I have not been able to pray. And then we talked about her attitude to the Lord and how she felt about people talking about her husband dying. And within a matter of 2 weeks, she was praying again. And I said to her, don't try for the moment. The Lord's holding you, the Lord's loving you, and it'll come back. And it's only when people strain to do it that they end up getting very angry at God.
Do you ever counsel people along lines that don't agree with your Christian principles?
Well, the question was, do I ever counsel people along lines that don't agree with my Christian principles? Well, no, I don't. But let me say this. What I thought, having read widely on the subject and trying to read as much as possible, I believe that none of the major fields of psychology are devoid of truth. Nor do I believe that any of the books of Christian approach to counselling are devoid of error. I believe that what we need is a real humility to accept that sometimes non-Christians can teach us, and at the same time a commitment to try to make a synthesis, to try to bring together this experience that we experience, the agony that people are going through, and the reality of the Word of God, the reality that we see and the biblical truth. And we need to try to bring it together. Now, I can honestly say, and I said this to Arthur earlier, I am still working on that. I have not come to a final conclusion on that. I believe there are broad principles that I can see and I'm working towards. My own feeling is that too many of the writers that have written Christian books have got one aspect of the truth and have then started churning out books on that one aspect. Instead of quietly working at it, realising the areas that need to be worked on and accepting the fact that we do not have all the answers. We desperately need people who are willing to tolerate not knowing all the answers, who can sit with people through not knowing the answers. Now, I suspect if you asked me, was what I did 12 months ago biblical, I would see some things that weren't biblical that I was doing and some things that were. And I hope in 5 years' time I'll be able to see more clearly the things that I'm not doing now correctly. So I suspect that all the time I'm a mixture of biblical and unbiblical thought, but I am trying to, and insofar as I do know, I'm not going against the testimony of Scripture. But I have been so consistently, I've consistently found myself to have distorted thinking, because I'm a fallen creature. And I find that on a whole lot of issues where I thought the answer was straightforward, that it's not straightforward at all. Yes?
You can give us any guidelines on this situation. When dealing with someone who's lost a loved one, and that person comes to Christ, and therefore has a very close affinity for the people that have counseled, to avoid that person becoming almost totally dependent upon you as the counselor.
Yes.
That's a situation that we have at the moment. Where did someone find a hand?
Yes, that's a real problem. It's called the replacement person problem. And what happens is for anyone who loses someone, there is a strong drive within them to replace them. For instance, if a person loses a baby, there's a strong drive within them, within either on the anniversary of the loss of the baby or within as short a time as possible to fall pregnant and then call the baby by the same name as the baby that they'd lost. And that's another situation where the baby is often at risk of being beaten, or the mother is at risk of falling into a deep depression if baby doesn't turn out to be the baby that they wanted. Now, the same situation occurs in the adult world. For instance, a person who has lost a partner can marry very quickly after losing the partner. And while they might work it through eventually, that's a very dangerous situation. That's a situation that we were talking about earlier that predisposes to real problems later on. Not always, but most times. And the other thing they can do is put you, who have come to help them, in the place of the replacement person. And they can begin to treat you, if they're a woman, they can begin to treat you with all the feelings that they felt towards their husband. And so that when that happens, very important that you point out what's happening. It's very hard to say to someone, you know, you're treating me as if I'm your husband. But I'm in that situation constantly. So I say to the person, I might say to them, you know, for instance, a saying in psychiatry is, we always say, beware of Greeks carrying gifts. Whenever a person brings us a gift, it always rings a bell in my mind. And when this person brought me a gift, I immediately said, you know, I wonder why you did that. And we talked about it. And I pointed out that for this person, they were doing it not as an act of kindness toward the person who had done them as a kindness, but as an act of a person who was showing love to a person who they loved. And a person isn't quick to pick that up. In our game, it's a very dangerous game. And the person who doesn't pick it up, you must be astute, and you're neither doing yourself good nor them good. And the trouble is, you know, it's almost tempting. We men love to be loved. And it's tempting to want people to love you in that sort of way. And to think you're the sort of person. In fact, it's not because you're anything wonderful, it's because they are desperate. And they need, I'm not putting you down, I'm not saying. so that's an important, and what I would do there, first of all, I would work through, what they're saying is, I'm not letting go of my husband, I'm holding on to you, and it needs to be said, it is hard to let go, isn't it? I notice how hard you're letting go of me. And you need to point that out and set your limits very clearly. In other words, when you see them, you don't extend the time. If they come to visit, you don't let them stay into the long hours of the night talking. In my case, I never go beyond my 45 minutes or 50 minutes with them. It's much easier for me. I'm doing it in a professional way. But I set my limits and I don't meet them on their terms. Otherwise, I quickly find that I'm on their terms, in their world, being the person that they've lost. Okay.
Given back to the Bible, last fall, there was a comment made that a certain professor at a seminary had told students coming through, theological students, that a good proportion of them would he advise them to do was to have another occupation besides their pastor's work. Because he said a good proportion of them would become unfaithful due to the counselling situation.
Yes.
And the article said they advised that women should counsel women and men counsel men. Now, we're all aware of somebody who was a highly skilled professional where the same problem occurred.
First of all, I think that there are very strong reasons why people go into their professions. I won't go into it in great detail, but suffice it to say this, that, and I recognise this for myself in more or less degree as for anyone else, one of the reasons people go into caregiving professions is because they desperately, many of them, need care. And often they are giving the care that they so wanted themselves from their previous life. Many of the people who go into the ministry are people who are resolving other people's doubts and fears in a way to attempt to resolve their own. There are many people who are preaching from the pulpit who, if they were pulled from the pulpit and not allowed to preach, would quickly dissolve into unbelief. You may not believe that, but believe me, there are some people who are preaching predominantly to keep their faith intact. Can people believe that? Maybe that's too much to believe. I've got a minister at the moment in intensive care at the Mater Hospital who is in just this situation. And people who have had meteoric rises to fame, particularly people with itinerant ministries, particularly people with international ministries. People, you know, and these people are really, many of them, coping with strong needs. And praise the Lord that he uses these needs normally to keep people looked after and cared for and so on. But unless these people get care, unless the minister has someone to minister to them, the full-time worker, someone to care for them, unless the carers are cared for, when the helpers feel helpless, they are in crisis. When the helpers feel hopeless to do anything for someone, they immediately feel a failure and become hopeless themselves. So that this is an area, the person who cares is a person at risk. The person who is a caregiver is a person at risk. And tonight I'll probably mention those why full-time workers, I believe, are particularly people who are at risk and we need to really care for them. You know, I've been very fortunate in the last 12 months, I'll tell you this as a personal, I have been cared for by some very caring people from Adamstown Gospel Chapel. And that has been a tremendous boost to me at a time when I needed it. And we need to care for the carers, especially full-time workers, because of the fact that often carers are people who desperately need care. I deal with all the nursing staff in our hospital, and we get one nurse a week who needs that sort of care. So let me just come back to the issue of ministers. Yes, it's often good for ministers not to be solely in that role, because it gives them time to mature in their whole personality, especially if they're going straight into... I think the whole idea of going straight into full-time work from the beginning has lots of problems. It's much better if a person's sort of been involved at other levels as well. Secondly, I think there are real risks to unfaithfulness, and the greatest risks... And again, I've got a whole lot of Christians that I've seen that this has been the case... The greatest risk is for the person who sees that this isn't a problem with them. In other words, if you're involved in counselling and you're feeling tempted, you're feeling the pull, you're feeling the fact, this person, I am sexually attracted to this person, you are already three quarters of the way ahead. The next thing is, what am I going to do about it? And what I do in that situation is I always, first of all, I store it and I say, now, is this something that the patient is sending out to me? That's the first thing. If they're sending it out, why are they sending it out? Do they do this with other people in their environment? In what sense am I being dragged in, like the rejection syndrome, in what sense am I being dragged into another syndrome? The syndrome of come and look after me, but do what I tell you. Don't disagree with me, doctor. Please me, doctor. Look after me, care for me, but don't help me. In other words, meet all my needs, but don't change me. And I will interpret that to the person. I'll say to them, I wonder how you're feeling towards me at the moment. And that takes a little bit to get used to. The person may say something like this, oh, I like you a lot, doctor. I say, what do you mean by like? You think, well, this might be just fishing for a situation, but most times what happens is you deal with it. And when you deal with it, this person will often receive a tremendous blow. I say to them, as it happens, I say, I get the feeling that you'd like me to be in love with you. And the person will absolutely accept. And I'll say, well, I never thought you... I've thought those thoughts, but I would never think of that. And then you see them, this tremendous depression come over them, that they've had to let go of that fantasy. And, you wouldn't do that with every person, obviously. You have to be very careful how you do that. But there are some people who you have to come to the issue. If you don't... You can be, even if you aren't unfaithful with this person, you are unfaithful to the task of helping them, because you subtly get dragged in to being nice with them. And so often people who are saying, look, you know, we've got a very this girl's developing spiritually, wonderful development spiritually. What they mean is, as we read the Bible, I feel tremendously sexually attracted to her. And, you know, whenever a person, if I see a person, I'm talking with them and I notice their pupils are dilating and their eyes are a little wider than usual and they're becoming a little flushed in their skin or whatever, and my heart's racing a little faster than usual, which is a good sign that I'm getting attracted, okay, then I say to myself, Ken, you've got to do something in this situation. And that happens all the time. If you think of your work situation and the women involved at work, I mean, depends where you work, but in a hospital, you're surrounded by beautiful women. There's a lot of these nurses are quite beautiful. Now, but hospitals run on sexual attraction. You've got the big, powerful doctors, you've got the sweet sisters, and they are constantly, you hear the doctors talking about the sisters and how attractive they are, and the sisters about the doctors, but no one would suggest it. I saw a doctor and a sister really having quite a fight with one another. I said to them, come on, you two act as if you're in love with one another. And they were so embarrassed. Because fighting, of course, is whenever you find someone who you habitually have a banter with, it shows that you're attracted towards them often. And you're keeping them at a distance. It's a way of keeping people who you're attracted at a distance. So whenever you see these two people who fight like mad and then get married, like my wife and I did, and we're still fighting, then you realise that there's an attraction involved. But really, we need to be aware how sexuality does pervade so much of what we do, and to deny it is to, I mean, it's one of the wonderful things, one of the reasons why men find it, most older men find it wonderful to take an interest in younger women, just in what they're doing in the local assembly and so on, But if you recognise that there's a normal aspect to it, women do make our lives much more colourful and everything else, but then there's the abnormal. And if you're aware of it, you'll pick it up. And I believe that the reason why some people fall into sin is because those people aren't aware how deeply they are attracted towards other people. And so they get themselves into positions which they should never do.
Encouraging our senior women folks and others to really get into the captain's training so that we can solve this problem.
I think that's a very, very good idea. I think it is because I deal with both sexes, but I agree that it does it certainly does make the situation a lot less complicated. I think that there are special situations that, they would have to be discussed, but there are special situations where the attraction towards the same sex is a problem. And, for instance, I work in a hospital where a large proportion of the people are celibate. And they are notoriously difficult in dealing with homosexuals. Because these people themselves, and I want to say this carefully and without any undermining of a lot of the good aspects of those who are in the Catholic celibacy positions, but there is a lot of aspects of sexual attraction towards the same sex, even if there's no sexual relations, that occur in groups of people who are all living together, whose main friendships are with all people of the same sex, be it priests or nuns. And that's a problem that I have had to deal with many times. And those people are really not able to. They're better not dealing with their own sex, and I think there are counselling problems with these people. Anyway, that's a bit of a side issue.
Can I just have a comment on the following situation? With people of mature years that are Christians, no doubt about they're born again believers, due to physical sickness such as hardening the arteries, they express themselves in certain terms to me, and I think it possibly follows a pattern, I'd like to comment. They at some point in time lose the assurance of their salvation, and they speak in terms that might be, actually what they're trying to say, but terms like, there's the blackbird sitting on the fence, he's here, he's every day, or the black sheep coming down over me. I'd just like to comment on that,
yes,
because that's very traumatic for other Christian members of the family, and they say, where is this peace that God we trust in to give?
Yes.
And someone said to me recently, yes, but God has got a portion of the brain that is his, and get all these thoughts, you know, just like a comment.
Yes. Well, let me, I'm just thinking of the most effective way of tackling that problem. Did everyone hear the problem? The person who's becoming demented, losing brain cells and so on, and at the same time losing their assurance of salvation. Let me say this first of all. By and large, depression in Protestant evangelical Christians presents with loss of assurance of salvation. That's one of the first things that goes. If a Christian feels low, they'll doubt their assurance of salvation. If you're a Catholic, they will present believing that they will never get out of purgatory. And if you're a Buddhist, some of them will present fearing that they will be reincarnated yet again at a lower level. Not a Hindu, sorry. So that depending on your cultural background, and an atheist, very interestingly, atheists, as you know, atheists suicide earlier than believers, but atheists tend to present with fairly, either they do one of three things, and Christians can do this too. If they feel depressed, they can put it out onto the world, and the world seems black and dark, they talk about conflict between the, everything they read in the paper becomes an object of concern. Or they can put it on their body and they can say, you know, look, I'm sure I've got something wrong with me. I'm sure I've got a cancer of the bowel. I just feel it's rotting inside there. Or they can turn it right in themselves and they can say, look, I'm just the most miserable person. So you can do those three things. But with the Christian who believes that they're a miserable sort of person, they often come out with the fact that they've lost their assurance of salvation. Now, then what do you do about this person? Well, I think the first thing is that most of those, except for, I mean, I've mentioned a couple that can't be helped, but most of those can be helped with the caring support and with some medication. Now you can say, well, why is it that these people lose their peace? And my understanding of the peace that God gives is that it is a peace in our relationship with Him. The war is over, and the peace has come. And that war being over and the peace having come means that very often inside, our lives can be characterised by a peaceful feeling. So there are different sorts of peace. But there are some people who, though the war is over, they can't understand that. They're losing their powers of reasoning. The retarded child, the child who's had brain damage, the person with mental illness, and this person who's losing their brain cells. 1 in 10 of us here will lose our mental function before we die. That's a high proportion. Several people here will have had a serious episode of depression. Quite a large proportion of the people here will have one relative who has a serious mental illness. And that means that for these people, peace is not the feeling inside. They may get it transiently, but it's only for a short time. One patient that I have has recurrent fears. Well, actually, I have many like this, have recurrent fears that they will do away with themselves. And they know that as a Christian, they don't want to do this. And the thoughts in there all the time, the thoughts tell them, kill yourself, kill yourself. Kill the baby, kill mum. And now you can imagine living with that thought just recurring in your mind. And it's very hard for these people to experience peace. And it's for that reason that I wait with eager longing for the coming of the Lord. You know?
families that are affected by this.
Yes.
It's a very dangerous situation. And you're saying we should all understand that that progresses from that person then to the family.
Yes.
And the family has doubts.
Yes.
Because they can't see it in living evidence, and someone that's physically deteriorating is prepared to accept that. Every day we're a day old and we can see physically deteriorate. But they think that mentally is something that we just can't understand because the brain's so complex, and you should be able to retain it.
Yes. Well, now that comes to the point of, can a person be physically healthy and spiritually unhealthy? Can a person be spiritually healthy and physically unhealthy? Can a person be emotionally healthy and spiritually unhealthy? Can a person be spiritually healthy and emotionally unhealthy? Do you get all that? And while all of those are interrelated, and while each is affected by the other, you do see people who are emotionally very healthy and spiritually unhealthy. You see people who are physically very healthy and spiritually unhealthy. Let me give an illustration, and I realise there are lots of weaknesses with the analogy. If you have a car, and you have a petrol tank, you have an engine, you have a steering wheel, etc., I want you to think of the emotions in a sense as the engine. And the car is the body, and the driver as the spiritual aspect of man. Now, often doctors as a whole deal with the body, okay? And some doctors and lots of other people deal with the emotional aspects of man, if you like, the driving aspects of man, the engine. And but spiritually we look at the direction and the will and the volition that the person has. Now, I believe I've seen many people who have been made remarkably better emotionally by non-Christian doctors, non-Christian psychiatrists. And I believe what they've done is fixed up the engine. They've given them no direction in which to head. And I don't believe we have to deny the value. There are lots of Christians who've got broken down engines, but they've got a good person at the helm, a good person at the steering wheel. And I believe that often what I'm doing is repairing the engine and repairing the body and then directing them to Christ for their direction, their spiritual direction. And a car just has no point if it doesn't have anyone driving it. And we have no point without the Lord. We have no direction. But our engines can break down just like any non-Christians.
Going on to another topic, what do I do as a Christian father if I have a child who is deformed, or has some other handicap?
Yes. Well, this is a very difficult area again, you know, because I think there is a commitment, of course, to love the child, but I think the first commitment is to be aware that, for instance, many of the Christian people that have deformed children make me aware that people have told them that perhaps the Lord really didn't want them to have children anyway. Now, I think that's a very caustic remark. And they say to them something like, for instance, someone who's having difficulty falling pregnant, they say something like this: well, you know, I knew so-and-so who prayed to the Lord to have a child, and they wouldn't accept that the Lord didn't want them to have the child, and then they had a child and it was deformed. Now, that's a little myth that goes around, and I think that's a very callous view of God. I think we need to be sensitive, first of all, to their needs, and most people aren't aware how bad a person feels when they have a deformed child, how they feel such a failure. And they feel that something that a lot of women will talk about feeling dirty, that they feel there must have been something dreadfully wrong with them. And the men feel a real sense in which, well, aren't I weak? My sperm weren't strong enough to get a full-blown good kid. Now, I know that sounds very primitive, but that's just the sort of thinking that we as humans think. And we need to be sensitive to that. and to realise that that child is going to be very hard for them to accept, and to realise if it's your child, that you will have difficulties and it's going to be very hard, and how hard it'll be to work through it, and to realise that for your wife sometimes she'll just want to run out. She feels a failure, first of all, for having the child. The child is increasingly difficult to look after. She'll sometimes not want to look after it, and she'll want to run away from it, because this child continually reminds her of her inadequacies. And then lastly, not only is she worried about that, but she's continually got the thought in her mind, what will the next one be? Will the next one be like this? And the question comes up, I wonder if it was me or my husband. Was it me or my husband? Where it can't be determined, I wonder if I got another partner, whether it would do better. You know? So those are all things. And the fear then of having another child, some women respond, some men respond, by not wanting to have any more children, so they withdraw from the other partner, refuse to have sexual relations or work all the time. Stay out all the time working and working and working. That's just a brief overview. I realise it's very superficial.
Prepare spiritually for the work.
Yes.
It must be a very short.
Yes, I can only give my suggestion. I set goals for myself in any year spiritually, and I spend an hour each morning. I just have a time of reading and a time of prayer. And I aim to try and cover areas. For instance, this year my goal has been to study the nature of man and try and make a link up with my work. And that's been a thing that I've been able to work on and think about, and so that if I don't have spiritual goals that are equal to my goals in my work, then what happens is your work consumes you and you lose all spiritual perspective. And I just see it sort of this ongoing need for education, but particularly from a spiritual point of view, I need other people desperately. I need other people to guide me, to support me, to encourage me, and I need the Word of God every day. And even then I feel barren often. At the end of the day I often feel very drained, and there are times when you just need time out. You just have to get time out.
How do you account for somebody that has a
lingering
aggressive feeling
after a driver in a car? Yes, and they were driving the car and the other person was killed. That's a common one, yeah. Well, the first thing I do is I go back to the source of the guilt, and I go back and work through the bereavement, and normally there are key times when that'll happen. The guilt will re-emerge normally with another loss, with when a relationship is in jeopardy and a potential loss, or on the anniversaries of the loss. And as you know, car accidents are very common on the anniversaries of loss of loved ones. Maybe you don't know. It's a very common thing. People having car accidents, they don't even connect the two events. And we had a case recently of a fellow who was killed. It was the third anniversary, and no one had picked up that he was always having it at the same time of year. And he'd killed two people already, and the third one he'd killed another one. And let alone that he had his license still, but you know, this is a problem that he would become profoundly depressed on that day and would have another accident. How do you deal with that person? You have to rework through the loss. You know, the Bible talks a lot about death and separation being equivalent. And in the human psyche, that is true. To have someone lost by divorce or by death has the same effect in some ways. And the person is profoundly affected and profoundly guilty, and you have to work through with them. There are four things that I always focus on with the person who has lost someone. I focus on the circumstances of the loss, looking at how it happened, how they saw it, what the loss meant to them, how they lost the person. For instance, if the person died by suicide, how did they feel? Did they feel they caused it? And let them talk about it. That's the first thing. Then I look at the support that they had at the time. Did people say to them things like, look, try not to cry about it, you don't need to talk about it, or you're doing well, wasn't it a victorious funeral? You know? And I'm always worried about victorious funerals because I think that often the deep grief, the person that, for the sake of everyone else, has covered over their hurt. You don't see many victorious funerals in the scriptures, really. And, you know, you see that we need to see that Jesus wept. And so I'll be with that. So that I think that the first thing is the circumstances of the loss, the support at the time of loss, particularly the sort of support that can let a person cry, let a person be angry. Thirdly, the relationship prior to the loss. If a person hadn't sorted out things before they've lost someone, they have to sort it out afterwards. Death does not solve a bad relationship. It only makes it worse. Particularly the relationship in which there were strong mixed feelings of love and hate, or feelings where the person depended on the other person. The dependent person very often is angry at the person for dying on them, which is always a surprise to people. And the fourth thing is, I ask them about what's happened since. Are they afraid? Have they had thoughts about the person which make them feel guilty? Are they guilty because they wish the person dead at times? And just to be able to talk about that can reduce their guilt. So you look at, for a person to be able to face all the things about it which are unpleasant, all the things about it which are unseemly, can often help and really reduce that guilt. And C.S. Lewis's book on that, A Grief Observed, is a great work. It's only a little book. I think we've gone well over our time.